Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It is August 14th, 2022, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or you can get in touch with me via email, jason@overthecap.com. As always, I'm joined by the bunny here, Nelly. Nelly, anything? Nelly's half asleep. So it's a Sunday night podcast, and I'll be getting up early tomorrow, so no beer of the night. I was hoping to do this last night. It was my wife's birthday yesterday. We didn't really do much for it. She just really wanted to go and take the kids to Dave and Buster's for the day. So that ended up taking a lot more time than I thought it would, which is perfectly fine by me. That was a nice little stone IPA day with some football, preseason football on. While the kids went and played video games, we ate some appetizers and stuff like that. So all was good. But by the time we got back, it was a little bit on the later side. And I just figured, I'll pass on it for now, and we'll try and get the podcast in on Sunday. I was hoping to do it a little bit earlier today, but my son's flag football started. I didn't even realize that was starting today, so we had to go to that. So we'll do this in the evening time and hopefully fly through this one. Really not too much going on right now anyway. Preseason is just beginning, and you're starting to see a couple of those injuries kind of pop up here and there. And obviously the one that I just want to start and talk about is the Jets here. What a killer. We were out Friday, so, you know, I was just kind of following along with the game on my phone. I had a radio broadcast going, and I was watching. The kids had a party to go to. And it was just terrible. You know, you watch the quarterback go down, and it's just like, this can't be happening. Now, as it turns out, it sounds like it's good news. It sounds as if it's just a bone bruise. And I guess he has a slight tear of the meniscus. Didn't sound like it was too big of a deal. They gave a 2 to 4 week timeline. I know a lot of the different doctors who do stuff online who all thought it was an ACL injury, they are thinking that it's more along the lines of a 4 week recovery. So hopefully that's what it'll be. Is it'll be 4 weeks. You never know what the Jets' medical opinions or whatever. You know, you could be here 4 weeks from now and there'll be no update on his health and he'll need to get like his leg amputated or something. That's as crazy as some of the Jet stuff goes with the medical stuff. But it looks like they dodged a bullet. One of the interesting articles I read about it said that it was actually because of the loose turf. That probably actually saved him from really getting the much worse injury. It's only a couple games into his career, and already, I mean, you just look. It's a bad history with the team. If you're just a fan of the team, you just are worried that this is going to be like a recurring thing. You know, is the knee just going to be a constant problem for him? Are they going to have to get to the point where he can't run like that, which is too bad because right now that's like the best part of his game. And I know a lot of people were getting on him for not running out of bounds or sliding or whatever and instead doing a cutback where he gets hurt. I get it, though. You know, he's a young player. He was awful last year. He's heard all offseason how awful he's been, you know, with the exception of the week where his ex-girlfriend was saying that he was dating his mom's friend or something. All he's heard about all offseason is how bad last year was, how it was like the worst performance you've ever seen from a young quarterback or among the worst performances you've ever seen from a young quarterback. He comes in, you hear all the glowing things in camp. You know, he looks like a different guy. It looks like he's matured 10 years in this offseason. And first thing he does when he goes out there is just looks like a lazy play, lazy read, like a practice rep almost, throws an interception. And that gets to you. So you're just trying to make a play. You're just trying to do something positive when you go back out there. I know it's preseason. I know it's meaningless. But when you're out there playing, you know, this stuff means something to you, especially after you've heard nothing but probably negativity. I'm not saying the negativity is not warranted. It's warranted. But that's all you've heard. You're just trying to make something happen. So I kind of understand that. Now, if you want to get on the staff for not having a game plan in place that basically says, look, other than avoiding a scramble, everything should be a throwaway. you know, I'm sorry, avoiding a rush to just scramble a little bit to the outside, you know, a couple of steps. Everything should be a throwaway. That I understand. But I doubt that's what their game plan was. I doubt that's what the instructions were with him. And this is what happened. So hopefully this will be it, because this would have been a disaster. I mean, this just would have been such a epic disaster on every level. And missing training camp and preseason, all that, it's not good. But at least you're still going to get a chance for an evaluation, because all you can think of with this is if he goes down before the season even begins, there's nothing to evaluate. You know, there's really not, because no matter how bad or how good maybe the team would have been, but probably more likely bad to mediocre with Joe Flacco at quarterback, or God forbid Jimmy Garoppolo at quarterback, all you would have heard about when it came to evaluating anything with a general manager, anything with a head coach, anything with anybody on the staff, it just would have been, well, they get it incomplete because the quarterback was gone for the season. How can you evaluate the job that's been done if they don't have a quarterback for the year? And it just sets your franchise back so much, because if Wilson stinks, you want to know that he stinks. And if Wilson stinks, and you combine that with the fact that the first draft class of Joe Douglas, I think we can flush that now like a John Idzik class. You know, if you have that and you have Wilson that stinks, well, now you got to say, okay, if we have a high pick again, do you really want Joe Douglas making that decision? But if the kid is sidelined for the full season or three quarters of the season, you don't have that opportunity. It just becomes a year where you just kind of shrug your shoulders at any event. Anything that could happen is just like, whatever, you know, good or bad. So thank goodness he's going to be playing this year, because this would have been just absolutely awful for the franchise. Obviously, there's a higher ceiling with Zach Wilson than Joe Flacco. There's a lower floor probably as well, but the main thing is evaluating. It's evaluating him, it's evaluating the rest of the team, and it's evaluating how the rest of the team plays with him. I don't really want to see them playing with Joe Flacco if I can avoid it. So luckily, they dodge a bullet there. They lose Mekhi Becton. I don't even remember when that was. It seems like a long time ago. It was probably this week. That was a crazy one too. You know, you're watching this video, and I don't understand how the Jets have him on the field. And I don't know if this is a situation of the boy that cried wolf. You know, I put it out there, like, how are the Jets having him practicing? So there was a video by SNY. You know, sorry, going off on a Jets tangent, but I think everybody knows a Jets fan here. They show a video of him practicing that day. He's basically doing individual drills. Just looks like he's laboring through them. Looks like he's going half a step slow. And every play, after he gets done with every drill, it's just he walks off to the side, grabs and clutches his knee, and just looks a mess. He's limping. He's just not moving right. And next thing you know, he's still out there. After you watch him go through at least, I think, three different instances of this, where there's nobody even around him. Like, one guy comes with Gatorade to him. You know, next thing you know, he's out there for team drills and just gets blown up and, you know, basically wrecks the leg, you know, wrecks his knee. And you just go, what went on there? So I had a lot of people that claim he just limps around after every play. And maybe that's possible. Maybe this is the boy that cried wolf syndrome, because I think the Jets were already half out on Becton to begin with. And, you know, his career as a Jet is probably done at this point. You know, you feel bad he doesn't even get a chance. But there was a worry when he got drafted that he wasn't going to be able to stay healthy, that he was just too big, you know, for his knees to hold up. Nobody thought it would have been this quick. But it looks like that's probably what's going to be the case with him. But I don't know if maybe they were just like, he's walking around and he's just limping around after every play because that's what he does. And in this instance, he's actually hurt. You know, it's hard for me to believe, watching him limping around like that, that he was perfectly fine and then just gets wiped out and it's all a coincidence. But maybe that is the case there. But he's going to miss the whole year. And a lot of people were critical now of the Jets for not having another offensive tackle they can play. The Jets were going to have another offensive tackle. Look, did it blow up on them that they waited as long as they did? It did blow up on them. But the Jets were always going to bring somebody in. The same exact way they brought in Morgan Moses last year. The plan, which they learned, and I think you give Douglas in the front office credit for this, when they first came into the job, they blew it with Ryan Khalil. It was a player who was retired. He was out of the league. And I'm not going to say they paid him top dollar. Maybe they paid him $8 million for the year. They basically got him to come out of retirement, decided, yeah, this is important to bring him in. Total waste. And the salary they paid him made zero sense whatsoever. This time around with Moses last year, what they did is they found players who were released, players that teams didn't want, you know, were sitting around. And you basically are going to them and you're trying to get a bargain contract with them and basically saying, look, nobody else around the league wants you. You know, your options are sign with us now, make a couple of million dollars, or wait, keep your fingers crossed, hope a contender signs you during the season, and you're probably going to play for a lot less money, and you might not even play at all, and that's probably going to be it for your career. And it worked with Moses, and it probably would have worked with Dwayne Brown this year. Now, Dwayne Brown was probably going to be harder to negotiate with than Morgan Moses, but, you know, they were able, you know, they were already discussing things with him. Because, look, if you asked Joe Douglas, Robert Saleh, whoever affiliated with the Jets, give me an over-under on Becton, nobody on that team was going to tell you 17 games. They're probably going to say 10. That was probably the hope that they would get out of Becton. So you were always going to have an insurance policy on the team, and the hope was that you'd probably have an insurance policy for $3 or $4 million. I don't have the contract details. It sounds like it's a two-year deal for about 10 a year, but there's a lot of different ways you can structure that to make that happen. It might not be that big. Brown is an older player. You know, you do have risk of injury there as well, but he's a good player. If he's happy with the money he's going to be making, he'll be fine. It gives you a little bit of insurance if something happens with George Fant, you know, in the offseason. I'm talking about to where you don't bring him back, because right now he's your left tackle. Brown can play either spot. So it's good insurance, not just for this year, but for next year, which is probably why they did a two-year deal, unless it was just totally done to inflate the annual value for reporting purposes. But, you know, even if they had to overpay, that's just bad luck. I don't think there's anything wrong with the approach they took, and I fully expect that they would have signed him anyway as Becton insurance, and it just would have been a situation where, much like Moses last year, it would have been like, look, we're going to sign you. There's no guarantee you'll play. You're going to wait for injury or ineffectiveness, because they're not sold on hard to believe that they would be sold on Becton. You know, and that's what they were going to do. So I actually think the Jets did that right, even though the situation maybe doesn't turn out right. But, wow, this could have just been so bad. And luckily, you know, knock on wood, luckily the quarterback should be okay. So we'll see where we're at a couple weeks from now and how the offense functions and how everything goes. But Hopefully, this is the end with the knee issues with him, and this is not going to be like a chronic thing where you just get worried the way, you know, if you're old enough to have watched Pennington, where, you know, every time it's just a worry. Oh, you know, what's going to happen? You know, what's next? So hopefully that we're not going to reach that state. A couple of new contracts came in. I'll talk about them. They're the wide receiver deals from last week, and I didn't do a podcast last week. But I think the more interesting thing is the Roquan Smith situation out in Chicago. So Smith is in the fifth year of his contract, and he's essentially holding in. He was put on the PUP list. They finally took him off the PUP list. I have no idea if he was actually hurt or not. I mean, you have to have some type of football-related injury from last season to go on PUP, so I'm sure there was something. Who knows if they were just kind of stashing him on there until they made last best offer. And when last best offer wasn't accepted, it was just like, all right, well, it's time to go out and practice. And basically he gets activated and he's not practicing. You know, he's taking part, it sounded like, in some type of individual stuff, but not practicing with any of the defense, to which I guess the coach was like, well, you got to go ask him. So the Bears quickly didn't make him available for any type of questioning. And it brings up a really interesting situation. And it's not about his contract itself. You know, we can talk about that for a minute. I'm sorry. We can talk about that for a minute. But it's about the concept of the hold-in. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. Maybe it was just the last podcast even. Probably talking about Deebo Samuel, maybe. But it was this concept of this hold-in. And it's like, where does this come from? And it's not like this is something completely new. This had gone on before in contract disputes. You know, Revis was a famous one, where basically you would show up and you would do a couple things and be like, hey, my ankle's bothering me, so I'm not going to practice because of my ankle. But you were showing up because if you didn't show up, you might get fined or you might void a guarantee or whatever. The penalties for holding out in the CBA are pretty substantial. And, you know, that's mainly for veteran players. But when you hold out when you're a fifth-year option guy, the NFL put in big fines. So it's, if I remember right, it's $40,000 a day. And for every preseason game that you miss, it's 1 week of your regular season salary, which is pretty pricey because you're on that fifth-year option. So it's clearly designed to make sure that people do not hold out. That led to this concept of the hold-in, which typically just takes place at the beginning of camp. And it basically took place in the 5 day window or so that existed in the prior CBA, which was you could hold out for 5 days and you basically weren't breaching anything. That was kind of the old system. So you could kind of get away with doing that. And, you know, the fines themselves weren't necessarily mandatory either. So that they were trying to avoid situations like this. I think the issue with this hold-in and where it came from is probably the language that's in the CBA. So really what you're looking for is under the section of unexcused late reporting to camp, you know, you've got this language here that's in the article. So let me just pull this up. So here's a breach as it pertains to the fifth year option in the collective bargaining agreement. After the club has exercised its fifth year option for any player selected in the first round of the 2016 or any subsequent draft, any unexcused late reporting to or absence from preseason training camp by a player in the fifth league year of his contract, the option year, shall subject the player to a fine of $40,000 per day for the 2020 to 2025 league year, plus 1 week's regular season salary for each preseason game missed. Blah, 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 about timelines here. I think the issue is the word absence. You know, if taken literally, absence means you are not present for it. And that would imply that you have to physically not be at training camp versus not participating. You know, I would think that that's the issue. And thus far, we have not seen any teams really challenge this. You know, they've always been working within this concept that, okay, the hold-in, wink, wink, nod, nod, it's okay. We'll agree with it. So you haven't had teams challenge it. My theory, you know, a couple of weeks ago when I spoke about it, was that at some point there is going to be a situation where you don't get a deal done early in camp and the guy's got to come and practice. You know, that there has to be a point in time. But again, when you get into what does the word absence mean, you know, I think that, I think at least that it leads to an interesting challenge that probably, if you did do it, if you were the Bears, probably goes to a grievance hearing, and you get a firm definition of the word absence. Now, I can tell you, now that you've got one situation at least brewing, and maybe they'll get this sorted out, but now that you have this, when you do have the next CBA, and that's long, 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 long ways down the line, but when you do have the next CBA happen, I think it's very clear that you will have something placed in there that will prevent the hold-in, that it will be absence from training camp and, not participating in practice unless medically excused. You know, something like that will be considered a breach, to where that they won't let it be a legal way to try to get around the concept of being fined, even though you're really holding out. You're just legally trying to find a way to avoid it. So I think that's probably what's going to happen. Now, as for what they do with a contract, I mean, look, the Bears are a rebuilding team. It's kind of pointless to re-sign him. If it was me, I think you would be looking to explore trades, for him. I'm not saying let him play the season out even. Yeah, the Bears do have a lot of cap space next year, and they're probably not going to get a compensatory pick because of that. But if you're a rebuilding team, I mean, how much does Roquan Smith move the needle for you, honestly? And that's not taking anything away from him as a player. It's just, what in the world does he mean to you when you have a team that right now has really nobody there? And I know that some people argue, well, you know, you want to set some type of culture in the locker room. Right now, the status of the Bears roster, the decision they make on Roquan Smith, is not going to poison the young guys in the locker room. It's just not. You know, the way that you handle veterans, when you that can have an impact. It has an impact, though, when you have a lot of guys in their third and fourth years, or players on their second contracts. It doesn't really impact you when you have guys first, second year in the league. They're still getting their feet wet, still trying to make the team, still concerned about that kind of stuff. And the veterans on the Bears teams, they know they're all stopgap players. They're just hoping to make a team and hoping to keep their careers going. You know, they're not going to be worried about, well, does this organization take care of me or not? You know, there is a time and a place for when you're sending messages to the locker room. And typically it has to do, in my opinion, with when you've got a lot of guys who are going to be coming up for new deals in the next year or 2 years. In Chicago, that's not going to be a worry for them. And most of the veterans on the team have already been shipped out. So you're not going to get the complaining in the locker room that might happen from those veterans feeling underappreciated by the team. You know, that aspect of it is all pretty much gone for Chicago. You know, if this was, you know, a situation where you were looking at issues with some players like a Khalil Mack, a Eddie Goldman, Danny Trevathan, you know, the guys who were there for a while on this last little run. That could potentially poison a locker room if you have a bunch of guys, you know, veterans there who are going to be respected, being like, oh, I can't believe what they're doing to Smith. It's basically Smith. I mean, yeah, Robert Quinn is still there. He knows that he's probably going to go at some point. I just don't see the benefit. And it's an interesting situation. You know, I pulled some numbers from PFF on him. And, you know, if you want to make a case, now he's representing himself, so there's some different stuff. But, you know, I want to look at certain players and just look at some of the things they did that might stand out when you're comparing. And, you know, basically you see he's on the field a lot. I was comparing him with Leonard and Warner and CJ Mosley, those types of players. And, you know, his pressure numbers are right up there with them. His stop percentages are very high. even relative to that group. He does get targeted a lot in coverage, which is a negative. But if you look at things with him, like a yards per target and stuff like that, I think what you're seeing is someone who's in a good position probably to make stops. He's just maybe not necessarily in the best position, to prevent someone from, even, approaching it there. But, he's in a good enough position to make that tackle on that running back or tight end or whomever pretty quickly, I would guess. Yeah, and definitely. I mean, you can look at the amount of yards that he's given up despite the higher number of receptions here. Pass breakups, interceptions, pretty much right on par with the rest of those players. But I think the issue there, you take the first round status out of it. I'm looking at these guys as, what was their best year? And, some of the players like a Leonard or maybe even a Deion Jones, those are guys who are pretty steady. There's a lot of steadiness in what they give you. Smith has been a little bit more up and down, and I think that's something. And then when you dig a little deeper into some stuff and you look at things like a Pro Football Focus grade, or if you look at PFF's WAR numbers on him, and I don't, WAR is probably not something that gets discussed that much, when you look at those kind of numbers for him, his numbers are very poor compared to a lot of these other players. So I think what that leads me to believe, I don't like using the phrase boom or bust with a linebacker. There's not really a boom that's going to be in there, but my guess is what you get with him are probably a decent amount of really good plays, probably just as many as the higher end players that you see, on the pay scale. I gotta get used to calling him Shaq Leonard or Shaquille Leonard instead of Darius Leonard, but doing similar stuff on the high end when he's, doing well, I guess, as someone like that, as a Warner, as a Mosley, and being able to put up those couple of things that do make you stand out, especially when you've got that first round, and in his case, a very, very high pick grade with him. And, you can compare on all that stuff. But if you're talking about someone who's got like a really low, WAR grade, where you're basically just average, what that tells me is you're probably making a lot of bad plays. And, a lot of bad stuff that can get done with linebackers is probably not going to get captured in any statistic. It's hard a lot of times to capture negative stuff in a statistic outside of, maybe coverage stats where you're talking about, catch rates and, just how many yards they're giving up to receivers, especially if you start looking at types of players they're covering and how much better those players are doing against you than they did against the rest of the league. Like, there are ways that you can really dig into that stuff. It's a little bit harder to do with this. And I think these numbers are kind of interesting because it can show you that a couple of like really good plays can maybe hide the fact that you're also making a lot of, lousy plays where you're biting on play action and you're just taking yourself out of a play completely. Maybe a play is going in one direction and you're going in the other. And that kind of stuff is probably captured actually pretty well in a grade, in a WAR statistic, because that's going on a more micro level and saying, okay, if we look at all these players, maybe we look at someone like a C.J. Mosley and say, C.J. Mosley was at his peak. He could 25% of the time, he was pretty above average. He was above average, very good, high level, whatever you want to call it. 50% of the time, he's probably pretty decent. And, 25% of the time, he probably makes a mistake. I have a feeling with Smith's numbers, you're probably looking more at saying like, well, he's pretty good 25, 30% of the time. But maybe 50% of the time, he's below average. And the rest of the time, he's average. And, that does set you apart because especially defensively, consistency is probably much more important than just being able to occasionally make an impactful play. And I know sometimes we really get on defenses and, you know, crunch situations, third and one, third and two, somebody makes a play, it's, you know, big deal, you know, interceptions. And you have that debate a lot on those types of players. You have players who get a lot of interceptions. They also give up a lot. That's a real boom or bust kind of play. The negative plays those guys make are actually probably worse for the team overall than the benefit that they're getting from some of those turnovers. You know, you're only as strong on defense really as your weakest player. And if you have guys who are making mistakes, you know, essentially you're, you know, 11 on 10 at that point. So, you know, I think it's got to be a consideration with him. Now, he's not going to sign unless that deal is going to be around 20, you know, you give him where he was drafted. But I can completely understand why the Bears would not want to continue with him. And I actually think it would probably be beneficial for them if they could trade. You know, if you can find a team that's willing to give you even just a second round pick for him, I would take it. You know, you are rebuilding. You are, you know, restocking your draft from, you know, some bad drafts and bad trades. Or just trades. Yeah, maybe some of them weren't even that bad. And I know you have all the money in the world, you know, that you're going to be able to spend in the future. But I'd rather have all that money in the world to be spending on, and I know next year is not a good group of wide receivers, but yeah, I'd rather be spending on wide receivers. I'd rather be spending on my offensive line. You know, I'd rather spend on a tight end. And, you know, I'd rather spend on some coverage guys than I would spending $20 million of my surplus cap space on an off-ball linebacker. That's just me. You know, it's very different. If you're a playoff team, you can use a player like Smith. You know, if you're that kind of team, you know, you can use those kind of players. It's almost like having a luxury. And if you can afford it, your playoff team, you know, if you're a team... Now, I'm not saying that the Bengals would be a fit here, and the Bengals aren't going to pay $20 million for linebacker. But when you've got your wide receiver on a rookie contract, when you've got your quarterback on a rookie contract, when you seem to hit gold with your edge rusher on a moderate contract, you know, when you have that kind of composition of your roster, you can go out and you can buy a player like Roquan Smith and pay him his $19 million a year. Yeah, that's probably not a bad fit. You know, if you were a team like the Chargers, now, well, the Chargers maybe not so much. They're a little bit more indebted in some areas. But, you know, if you're going to do that, I mean, you can go out and you can do that. But, you know, I just don't think it makes sense for the Bears. You know, I just don't think it's going to move things one way or the other. But the interesting thing is just going to be where this stuff, you know, lands afterwards. So that's one of the interesting ones going on. So the other thing really that we looked at here, so I have a thing on defensive spending. We can talk about that next week. But it was just the wide receiver contracts that came in. So the Deebo Samuel one came in, and I was surprised. San Francisco really did give in on a lot of things here. They didn't do the long-term deal. You know, it's just a three-year deal with a bunch of void years. They gave him a pretty big guarantee. The cash flows are nowhere near the level of the DK Metcalf deal. Didn't think they would be. Obviously, they get their per-game stuff and all those things. But, you know, eventually it will match the Metcalf deal. You know, it'll come pretty close to matching it in years two and year three. It's just not the monster money up front. I think part of the reason San Francisco did it, I think at least, is I have a feeling they looked at this and they probably were like, okay, He's going to be at the end of this deal, 29, I believe. It's a 3-year extension. Yeah, he'll be 29 going on 30. So I think they looked at this and they said, well, you know, is it really going to be a situation where we definitely are going to want him, you know, that he's going to be that effective? And I think when you look at a lot of the players around the league, you would say probably not. And then on top of that, you know, you're pairing him up with your rookie quarterback, and you're probably going to know by this year or next year, definitely by the end of next year, you know, is Trey Lance the real deal or not? So, you know, at that point, if Samuel's still very effective, you know, in his third year on this deal, you have a lot of decisions you can make. You could trade the contract, you know, the same way the Chiefs did with Tyreek Hill. You can extend him and then do that deal further, because he might be unhappy with the numbers anyway, you know, 3 years from now, and that group, that agency has already set that standard with Aaron Rodgers and Aaron Donald to be able to figure out ways to dig in and just get yourself brand new contracts. So, you know, you know you're dealing with that to begin with. So, you know, maybe, and I shouldn't have said that I'm mixed up on that. Samuel's not part of that group. This is Dandy's group. This is CAA. I was thinking Athletes First. It's CAA. So yeah, maybe that part of it's not so much in there. But anyway, you know, I think that they would look at this, and that's probably their logic. It was just like, we want him here. We need him here. We want to pair him with him. Let's get the finances down to something that works for us. And odds are we're not going to need that 5-year deal. It's a different position than some of the other ones where we're sticklers on the 5. Will that come back and bite them at other positions? Anything's possible. But I think that's the logic behind that. Then you had Deontay Johnson come in, and I thought he got a really light contract. I thought this was a really good deal for the Pittsburgh Steelers. It's not a terrible deal for him either. But I thought this was a really good deal for him, because if you look at Johnson right now is just he's a target hog. All right, you look at his stats, they don't really stand out. You know, we discussed him a little bit the other week too. You know, he's someone whose numbers, they're volume numbers. And I'm not sure how well he would be received in free agency, because a volume monster who is not hyper productive, not somebody sometimes that's very desirable, despite the fact that they're putting up 1,000 yards a season. You know, it's a game where you look for explosive plays, big plays, and he's basically a slot receiver not playing the slot. So I think that maybe was a factor that he would have considered, you know, maybe when thinking about free agency. You know, obviously Juju Smith-Schuster had a very difficult time in free agency, though he was coming off worse seasons. But, excuse me, the Steelers, you know, are going into a complete unknown area with a quarterback. And his numbers, if you're not throwing the ball 600-something times a year, and he's not getting targeted 150 times a year, his numbers are going to fall to a level that's probably not a 1 or a 1A. And that might just make sense then to get a deal done, even if the numbers themselves are not going to match the $20 million plus a year that you were hoping for. You know, when he comes in at the higher end of the second market at 18, you know, 18.4. You know, so I can kind of see where he was coming from with maybe that logic. You know, because if the Steelers go back to a running offense, which they did the last time Ben got hurt, it wasn't a running offense, but they dramatically dropped down on the number of pass attempts. You know, it changes a lot of stuff, and maybe that would have really impacted him. So, you know, it's not a great deal. It's a 2-year deal, $18.34 million a year. He's got $19 million guaranteed at signing. He's got 24.2 guaranteed for injury. It does not vest, but he's got a roster bonus in the second year. So, you know, a roster bonus next year, I should say. That's technically the first new year. You know, he'll make $16 million this year. That's a lot less than the A.J. Browns and those guys, but it's not that far off. It's about $4 million off. So, you know, you can pair that up and then see through next year he'll have made $26.7 million in new money. That's much better than getting franchise tagged for him, and that's probably where that deal stood out. Again, it's not the big money of these other guys. $26.7 million is $3 million a year less, $3 million less than DJ Moore. It's about $5 million less than Terry McLaurin. So, you know, doesn't crack those numbers, but at least it's a pretty reasonable payoff. And then obviously if he makes it to year two, there's a lot less for him to gain there. But I thought the interesting thing that happened with him really was the amount of people, and you know, some of this stuff is just like you can't take some of the things. Like, well, I'll pick on Rappaport for a minute. When Samuel got his deal done, it was like, the bridge has been rebuilt. Like, what are we talking about here? The bridge has been rebuilt. You know, if a guy's really unhappy with the organization, giving him the money is not going to rebuild any bridge. Did Odell Beckham and the Giants love each other after they gave him a big contract? No, they shipped him out. You know, that stuff doesn't mean anything. But, you know, the stuff we go overboard with is sometimes the length of these deals, saying, okay, this one was a win-win because Johnson's only signed for 2 years, so he's going to get back to free agency. Samuel got the 3 years. You know, when we talked about DK Metcalf, DK Metcalf is young. You know, not that these guys are old, but DK Metcalf is like incredibly young. You know, Diontae Johnson, so he's 25. So he's going to play out this year at 26. He's going to play out the next year at 27. And if he's still on the contract, he's going to play out that year at 28. Then he's going to be a 29-year-old free agent. You know, it's all well and good to say that, you know, short-term deal, where we talk about these guys on these prove-it contracts. In the NFL, you age like dog years. I think I said that on Twitter somewhere, whatever. It's not 1 year in the NFL is like 5 or 6 years of a real career. You know, it is not the same thing. If you're going to be a free agent at 26 or 27, it is not the same thing as being a free agent 29 and 30. Are there players that do it? Yeah, there's players that do it. You know, Hill was older, Keenan Allen. But, you know, they're the exception. You know, Diontae Johnson, it's probably more of an uphill battle for him. You know, if you want to look at, you know, players who made a lot of money, you know, going into free agency at that age or getting extended at that age, that list isn't that big. You know, it's just not. You know, there are a couple players who do, but, you know, you're talking about elite-level players. You know, DK Metcalf, in my mind, is an elite-level player. You know, Julio Jones was an elite-level player, and, you know, he was still very productive until 30, and then he was pretty much done. You know, 31, 32 was not kind. It was injuries and ineffectiveness. You know, there's... You know, you can look at a lot of players like that and you start to wonder, you know, at what point does it stop? And Diontae Johnson, he's not in that upper echelon of player to where you can be counting on this to be like, yeah, okay, a couple of years from now, then I'm going to get to free agency. And let me tell you, I'm going to hit it big then. And that's one of the reasons why you do try to get more when you do even these short-term deals. You know, you would have hoped, I think, in his case, certainly to go past that $20 million a year mark, you know, rather than just that first-year payment. But I think we really overdo it. Even when we look at these guys on these prove-it contracts and go, good for him. You know, he signed for 1 year. Look, where did he get Will Fuller? No, it doesn't get a lot of players anywhere. You know, there are occasionally guys, yeah, they do. They make the most of that season. For a lot of guys, for the majority of them, your best chance at making money in the NFL is your first shot at free agency. Not a second shot. Not a third. Not a shot 4 years later. It's your first shot at free agency. A couple positions, you know, quarterback, left tackles, maybe some guards. Yeah, you it's a little bit different. But for the majority of positions, you know, you need to be focused on that first contract. And if you can't get that first contract, you want to get back into free agency 27, 28 years old. Not 29, not 30. Don't chalk that up as like a big win. You know, that's a win for the team a lot of times, because they have not crafted a contract that's going to lock themselves in on a player to where they can't walk away. They're getting out light compared to other receivers on the market at the same time. And, you know, the upside probably isn't there for you. And you know what? If you outplay your contract and they do sign you to a 3-year extension, which would be the likely, that would be like your best case outcome, odds are you're still going to be underpaid, you know, over that 5-year term. Well, if you happen to you know, really outplay your contract, if you were one of those guys, you know, over that 5-year term, you're probably going to end up underpaid. So, you know, I think we just go overboard way too much. You know, if you go back and you look at, you know, who were the top 15 paid wide receivers just a couple of years ago, and I don't have the numbers right now in front of me, but you know, you would have seen names like Julio Jones and Antonio Brown and Odell Beckham. You know, Michael Thomas is hanging on by a thread. I know that we're talking about him in training camp. The reports out of New Orleans, like, oh my God, it's like, you know, he never left. He's like better than ever. You know, DeAndre Hopkins is probably nearing something. You know, you just look at that list of players. You know, Amari Cooper's still around, but he's not on Dallas. They traded him away. They were going to cut him. So, you know, Jarvis Landry is like on a minimum contract. You know, these were all highly sought after and highly compensated players just a couple of years ago. And, you know, it doesn't work in the NFL. So, you know, I think you just don't want to beat up the point at some of these players about the years on the contract at certain positions and individuals, when you look at their individual situations, regarding age, maybe talent level, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, if he's happy with the deal, and like I said, it's better than the franchise tag. And if that was what he was fearful of an outcome, you know, he's going to get compensated better than that. They can walk away, but he still walk away with a big raise, you know, for this year if that happened. So, yeah, but I think that's an interesting discussion, and maybe that warrants a little bit more research on my part, you know, just to put some concrete numbers out there for the quote-unquote prove-it deals and the contracts that were looked at. You know, as can't miss, but you know, I know I've done that with free agency, and you can see how those end. But maybe I got to do a little bit more on extensions with some of these players to see where they rank. But I think it's almost like playing into a team's hand with some of the stuff where we go overboard with, oh yeah, it's great, he's getting back into free agency in 2 years, 3 years. It's like he's probably not. People are going to be like, oh yeah, he happens to be in free agency. You know, Sammy Watkins, that'd be another one that was highly compensated a couple of years ago, hanging on by a thread. So I think that's it for me for that. So let's get to questions here. So I think I had a question the other week, and I don't think I answered it. I think I saw it in my email. Let's see. I thought I did. Something... This is from Ken. Can you explain how termination pay works? No one expects Adams and Hill to play out the final years of their contracts because of the bloated salaries. Could termination pay be an issue? I don't think I covered this on the last podcast. So, no, termination pay is basically veteran players get a guarantee. Maybe I did talk about this, but veteran players get a guarantee on their salary one time in their career, basically one time in their career, for their entire salary if they're on a team's roster in week one, on the 53-man roster in week one. If they're on the roster in week one, their salary is guaranteed for the whole season. If they're cut in the preseason, regardless of what their salary might be, termination pay doesn't come into play. So termination pay is only for players who actually make the team. That's why you see a lot of lower-level veterans get cut Friday or Saturday before the first game, and then they're re-signed Monday or Tuesday. That's simply to avoid the salary being guaranteed for the year. When you get signed in season, you get, I think it's 25% of your salary guaranteed. And it used to be you could only claim termination pay once. Now you're allowed to do it twice, I think, provided that the that one of the claims is only for like a couple of weeks, like 2 weeks or a week's salary or something like that. But for players like this, no, it would not be an issue. Wouldn't even be a consideration. Injury protection, you know, might be a little bit of an issue, but probably not. You know, and the injury protection we're talking about is like $2 million, $3 million, by that point in time, maybe $3 million or something, $2.5 million. And that would be kind of a universal thing. Anyway, it applies to pretty much all your players who are making over, you know, that amount of money. So, yeah, I don't think that would be an issue probably either. Okay, let's see. Max has a question. Do you think there's any reason beyond not wanting to pay the compensation fees why certain players don't hire agents? It seems like Roquan Smith, Lamar Jackson not having agents made both their negotiations more difficult than it needs to be. Let's see. There is no one who can call the other side, blah, blah, blah. I'm just trying to see if there's anything else here. I'm not sure if you saw this, but Pro Football Talk reported there was someone, not an actual agent, calling teams on Smith's behalf, which seems like a disaster waiting to happen. No, I did not see that article. There's a link here. Let's see what this is. Now, who knows with Florio, with what information he got here or not. So basically, I think, yeah, the compensation fees are an issue. I think there's also people who distrust a lot of agents, that they think that the agents are not necessarily negotiating on their behalf. You know, I think when you look at Orlando Brown, for example, one of the things that he brought up when he did finally hire an agent was he wanted someone that had no linkage to any front offices in the NFL. Like there was no way that he thought that there would be a you scratch my back, I scratch your back part of a deal. And that just tells me that maybe there's an inherent distrust behind what some of the agents do. For some of the players too, I think they enjoy the ability to get to negotiate for themselves. You know, it's kind of like doing something for yourself, and you're only going to get one or two chances to do it. So I think there's a reason for that. It can make things more difficult because you don't have a middleman to intercept a lot of stuff. And I think that can be hard. And the other thing that's hard is you do not have the media connections that most agents do. Most agents can very quickly and adeptly turn a story on your side with the information that they will feed to, you know, the Adam Schefters of the world, because there will be a spin that is put on the stuff that is really, really, really strong in your favor. You don't have the ability to do that when you're representing yourself. You don't have those relationships with those reporters. They're not going to get a long-term benefit. So the most you're getting is a scoop on, you know, one thing, nothing else, really. So you're not going to have that, and you're probably not going to be experienced enough to know how to try to spin something in your favor, completely in your favor, the way that a seasoned agent is going to do that. So I think that that's kind of an issue. So Smith, I think he released a statement through Rappaport, I think was the trade request statement. You know, and that's about as far as that got. And so you can see the differences. You know, it's not followed up with, you know, he's the greatest linebacker, you know, doing this, that, and the other thing. He's the only guy to do this. He was drafted this spot by the Bears. The Bears just aren't taking care of their guy. You know, none of that stuff. You know, the Bears aren't being serious with any of their issues, yada, yada, yada. As for the, you know, somebody calling. So these guys who represent themselves, most of the time they do have a team they work with. Depends on who those teams are. Well, I have not specifically worked with a player. I know guys who have, who are former agents. So obviously they know the lay of the land. There are plenty of teams, despite what Florio is mentioning here, there are plenty of people who do work at agencies who are not certified, but they basically will talk on behalf of the player with the teams. It's just that they're not part of the final deal, but they know that those players are, or those people are working with the player. They know that they're part of the agency that's representing the player. And look, they're not going to care about it because they know it's on the up and up. So there's no issues, you know, trading, you know, numbers back and forth with those people. But then the final deal itself is going to get done by, you know, the agent. So the same thing probably happens when somebody is self-representing themselves. You know, when it comes to this, the problem is when your representation comes from people who probably are not familiar with the NFL. And so not only are they not certified, but they don't understand the process. And that's a little bit different. So if you have people informally just reaching out to other teams being like, hey, yeah, I'm kind of representing him. You know, I'm looking over his contract form. Are you guys interested in him? You know, that kind of stuff. That's going to be a problem because that's going to limit his market, because even if you trade for him, you can still open yourself up probably to a grievance at some point. You know, you just saw the tampering stuff that went on with Miami. So, you know, you want to steer clear of that at all costs. So if somebody is really doing that, that could definitely be a problem. And that would be something that he is going to, you know, he should put a stop to it. You know, and if it did happen, that's something where, you know, the Bears general manager probably has got to, you know, call him up or email him and be like, hey, you know, we've just got to, I just want to make sure, you know, I don't think it's happening, but if it's happening, you know, make sure it, you know, doesn't happen. You know, I think that's the issue. All right, let's take a look at Twitter. Tarish says, thoughts on the Chris Boswell deal? You know, it's a kicker contract. Not really a big deal, one way or the other. I could pull up the stuff. I think I don't know, unless it's Tucker, I think all these deals are basically a waste, but, you know, they like Boswell. So, you know, he's been there for a while. So let's see, he signed for five a year, I think. You know, he was going to tie Tucker for highest paid. Let's see, he gets 10.64 by the end of the first year. That's better than Tucker, who's just a little bit lower than that on his new extension. He'll be 13.76 after two. Tucker's at 14.65. He'll be at 16.88 after three. Tucker will be at 18.8. And then you got 20 versus 24. So, I mean, it's a big jump forward from, I guess, the Coup deal was, I think, the next highest outside of Tucker. That was 15.5 over three. So he got up to about 17. They didn't give him credit for that 17th game. They gave like a partial credit. It was weird, but yeah, it's a deal. So, you know, it's a kicker deal. I don't really get too into it. Ken says, should the Jets pick up Becton's fifth-year option at the end of this year so they get it for two more years at a reasonable price? I think they won't sign him long-term even if he has a good year, so keep him for two instead of one, then tag him if needed for a sixth. or not worth the cost. No, it's not worth it. I would be shocked if the Jets picked up Becton's tag. I don't think the Jets are an option. I don't think the Jets were high on him to begin with. He's had awful medical history. Hurt most of last year. Hurt all of this year. Hurt part of his rookie year. I know there's some talent there, but you're looking at a guy who, at this point, hasn't really played competitive. He's not going to have played competitive football for like three years. And maybe you could even go back to like college. He probably played enough that rookie year to where you would say it's all right to use that. But no, I would be shocked if the Jets picked up that option. Thoughts on Zach Wilson from a durability perspective. Like I mentioned earlier, I think you're already starting to get worried. The only thing is that he's so small, not height, just his frame. You're worried, was he going to stand up to getting hit? So at least he hasn't gotten hurt getting hit. But yeah, I think at this point you have to be concerned with the knee and wonder if this is going to be a game-changing injury at this point, to where they're going to say North-South has to end, as part of the game plan. That it's all east to west running, and you either throw or you don't throw, and we're taking the running part out of the equation. And that'd be a shame, but I think that might happen. Any details on the Dwayne Brown contract? 22 for 2 would seem to be, would have to be heavily backloaded to fit under the cap this year. Lots of fluff to get that figure through incentives, similar to the Rafe deal. Yeah, I mean, they might do something like that. Where they can drop it. I mean, the Jets have some cap room. It's not like they don't. They have about $8 million in cap space. Now, that's going to drop when you get to regular season stuff, and the regular season is what counts. But, I mean, they can easily take like a $4 million cap hit, throw a bunch of void years on there, do a big signing bonus. There's a lot of things they could do to make the deal work out. I would imagine there's a lot of incentives in there, but we'll wait to see. I don't have the details yet. If anyone has them or you see them, you can tweet them over, email me or whatever. Let me know. If Baker Mayfield has a top 15 quarterback season, what do you think his contract would be? I think he'd be franchise tagged. I don't think the Panthers would do an extension on a top 15. I think they would do an extension if he had like a top 5. I think anything else than that, I think you use the tag and you just see how things go. What's the podcast? If you made it this far, you found it. Black Gold. In the off chance a team ever gave a player equity in a contract, how would that go in the cap? Could you do any similar type of cash restructuring? I don't even think you're allowed to do that. If you did, they would have to somehow get a valuation on what that is worth. And it would be part of the contract that way. And I would imagine it would be treated as like a signing bonus or something like that. But it will never be part of any NFL contract. Anthony, do you think the reason Dwayne Brown took so long to sign in the end had to do with Becton's injury? If so, what do you think the initial price tag would have been? So I think the initial price the Jets were probably hoping for was 3 or 4, million for the year. I don't think that's why he took so long to sign. I don't think he was waiting to see if Becton would get hurt. I think he was waiting to see if anyone around the league would get hurt and that there might be more interest in bringing him in somewhere else. If the Jets weren't going to come up in money. Brown has been driven by money is not fair, but Brown has been involved in a couple of contract disputes before. Going back to Houston, I believe. And that one, I guess, was a partial, he was not happy, with the owner. There were some issues there. I think related to, the owner's issues with, racism and stuff like that, if I remember correctly. If I'm wrong on that, I apologize. Then I'm just misremembering old age. you know, as to what that dispute was. But I think, but regardless, there was a dispute with his contract there, and he wasn't playing, and he was unhappy with his contract last year in Seattle. And, you know, so it's not that you don't want to say driven by it. You know, I think he understands the business side, probably the NFL, better than maybe a lot of other guys do. And I think probably just, you know, was trying to do the best he could to protect himself. And I'm sure the same situation was going on here. Once Becton got hurt, then it became an easy one to do because the Jets move into a little bit more of a desperate mode, and he was probably the best available. Apologies if you already covered this. This is from John. I'm behind on the podcast. Have you touched on the Brown statement that the Watson contract structure is not unusual and what they've done with other contracts? Is that true or simply an attempt to deflect criticism? So it is true in the sense that, yes, the Browns typically do signing bonuses for their players, you know, that are pretty large. The basics of it, yeah, I don't know. You know, it's okay. So there's a couple things. Number one, a fully guaranteed contract is in no way, shape, or form normal for the Cleveland Browns. A contract that doesn't void for any and all possible suspensions from the NFL is not common for the Cleveland Browns. Contracts with a signing bonus of this magnitude, not common for the Cleveland Browns, but you can give the benefit of the doubt and say, well, you know, there's not many, you know, players that they have that would measure up. And, you know, Myles Garrett probably had a similar structure. They don't use the double options in here. And I would imagine that probably has something to do with things they can do in the event that he got suspended in the future. So that's not common. And obviously giving a guy a one-year raise for about $100 million is also not common. So there's like 8 million uncommon things with this deal. Now, I've said it before, and I'll say it here too. Any team in the league would have done the signing bonus for him. No other team would have given him a raise, though. And that's what the Browns did. So I think the signing bonus aspect is probably a little bit overblown. The optics of it are terrible, and you have to know that ahead of time, that those optics are going to be awful. But I do believe any team in the league would have done that, but they would have done that based on his existing salary, which was, I don't know, in the 30s maybe? What was his existing salary this year? When he was in the Texans in 2022, yeah, it was 35. So it would have been on a 35, not on a 46. So, you know, all those other things are not common, though. They're not anything that the Browns do with any of their contracts. So, you know, that's why I think more so than that like, you know, the bonus thing is just bad. It's just a bad look. But all the other stuff, none of that stuff is normal for the Browns. And it's not normal for any team in the league. So there's no point in attempting to claim that contract is legitimate. There's no attempt for them to now have him after he said he did nothing wrong during his hearing, during anything else. There is no reason at all for them to now have him going out there and say, oh, now I apologize, because he's trying to you know, set himself up for his appeal decision as best as possible. I don't even want to get into that whole mess. We'll deal with that when that happens. But yeah, it's just ridiculous that they, you know, they even bother with some of that, trying to defend it. Corey Booger, do you have any strong opinions on Mustard? No opinions on Mustard at all. Your best guess as to what the Bears will do with Roquan Smith and what a possible extension would look like. So my guess is an extension would probably be something like, I guess it would be a five-year deal. And I don't think that they would go to 20. My guess would be 5 years, 19 a year with upside, incentives. They could push her higher. 50 guaranteed in that ballpark. Would be my assumption of it. Per game stuff would probably be in there. All the other linebackers have it. Leonard's got 2 million. Warner's got 2.5. Deion Jones has 2.5 almost. Two of the guys have workouts. I think that's probably what you'd be looking at. To get a deal done. As for what the Bears will do, I think for Chicago, it's important to do a deal like on your own terms. Don't do anything too crazy. That sets you up bad in the future. So, you do something normal. If you're looking for a nice PR thing, you'd probably get the deal done. If you don't care about that, I would think that you would explore trades for him after the season begins. Let's see. Do you anticipate any more big money extensions before the season starts? Or do you think most negotiations would go on hold? No, there'll be some others. Whether it's Smith, and that question's from Jacob, whether it's Smith, whether it's Lamar Jackson, there'll be other deals done. Typically, the real closing deadline for the NFL usually is the Friday before the second game of the season, or Saturday before the second game of the season. That seems to be the ultimate deadline. You will see deals that can go down anytime after training camp to the first game of the season. Now, usually that's what happens, is you get through training camp and then talks resume in that window between the end of camp and the start of the regular season. But for some of the things, they do go into that second week, after the first week. So I'm pretty sure that there will still be some that come through. Chris, does the cap exist? Yes, the salary cap does indeed exist, despite what people will try to claim. Adeptus Serpentis, if I'm saying that right. How embarrassing will it be for a team to inevitably lose a game to the Chicago Bears in their offense that has so little money invested in it? They don't have much invested in the defense either. Chicago is basically following the Jacksonville model and Miami model from a couple years ago of just blow it all up, which is what you got to do. It'll probably be bad. The only thing I'll say in Chicago's favor is if Justin Fields is really, 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 really good, he'll make some of that ragtag offense probably look competent. If he is not, if he's just an average guy, then yeah, you're probably going to be like, oh, how are we the team that lost to the Chicago Bears? How is that possible? How did we lose to them? Whether they win two games, three games, whatever it is, I could see that being a possibility that you get a couple teams that are just like, oh, I can't believe we lost to them. Canes, best free agent pass rushers available in potential landing spots available next year? I don't really know who's available, right now, like via trade. You'd be looking at someone like a Robert Quinn. If you're talking about just availability right now, let me see who's left. I don't even know who's left on the market. Edge. Oof, this is a yucky list. There's really nobody of note. Jason Pierre-Paul. I have no idea where he would even fit in. He's 33 years old. Alex Okafor. Everson Griffin. Ryan Kerrigan. He may have officially retired. Tack McKinley, Whitney Merciless, Trey Flowers, Carl Nassib. I mean, this is not a who's who's list. I mean, these are guys who maybe you'll get a look for practice squad kind of stuff if they want to do it. You know, injury protection. So if you're talking about this year, I mean, it's not a good group, you know, that's available. You know, the guys that can play, and they don't last. You know, they just don't. So, you know, as for next year, I'm not sure if there's really much available there either. But too early to look at that. Commanders, Drew White tore his ACL in camp. Is there a way to know the injury settlement? Do you think players like this make enough or have enough financial security? Well, none of the players really have enough financial security. You know, an ACL would mean he'd be out for the season, so more likely than not, there would not be an injury settlement. You know, I think what would happen here is because he tore his ACL, he would miss the entire season. So, you know, his whole salary is going to be covered. Now, he's probably on a split, which means he'd make $430 this year. And ACL is pretty serious. So odds are that means he would qualify for injury protection next year and the year thereafter. You know, if he can, you know, if he basically can't play football anymore, you know, he might qualify for it. So that would also be a reason why I would think that you might look at this from his perspective and say, well, don't agree to a settlement, just remain part of the team. And if they cut you next year and you have a failed physical designation along with it, you know, there's a possibility that you might make more money due to that. So I would think that would be the right course of action for him. But do you think players like this make enough or have enough financial security? I mean, none of the guys really have enough financial security, you know, for this sport, but you know, that's bargained. You know, it is what it is. And when you're a UDFA, I mean, you're just getting a minimum type contract. What do you think about the Jets picking up Garoppolo? And what is it worth to the Jets in cash and draft capital? Oh, God, no. No, no, no. No Garoppolo. Look, Garoppolo's injury prone. There is zero upside with him. Just stick with Joe Flacco and Mike White and whatever, however bad it might be. You know, people tell me, hey, you know, Garoppolo's been in the playoffs. Joe Flacco won a Super Bowl. Okay? Doesn't mean anything Joe Flacco won a Super Bowl. You know, Joe Flacco's no good either. You know, Joe Flacco win you a couple games. But, you know, you take Garoppolo out of, you know, good environments, you know, unless you really believe the Jets are that set, I just wouldn't see a purpose. And he's probably going to get hurt too. You know, he's always an injury risk as well. So I'm not trading for him. There's no way you trade for that contract at all. You know, so I don't know what he would be worth, a couple million bucks. But, no, there's just no way that you would do that. Brian, what happens to the Dolphins cap with the fine levied against the owner? Does it apply to their 2022 or 2023 cap, or is it just Ross as well? So I think it's just a fine, so it doesn't have anything to do with the salary cap. So that should just be something that he pays, and then the NFL will donate that to charities, usually is how that goes. Ross probably can pick the charity, but I believe it goes to charity. Last question from Dave. In your opinion, what is the difference in how a front office should operate comparing those who have franchise quarterbacks versus front offices who don't? That's a good question. You know, so if you have a franchise quarterback, you know, the handful of players, or handful of teams, I think when you have the franchise quarterback, you have the luxury to begin to pick and choose how do you build around that player. And I think once you do that, what you're looking to do is just have certain steady streams of talent that's going to come in around him. And in my mind, you know, it's very important to have young receivers because, like I talked about before, you know, receivers make it to that second contract, probably aren't making it to a third. So you want to have, in my opinion, like a nice little staggered group of receivers to where you have a high level, quote unquote, veteran, you know, fourth, fifth year player, and you also have a rookie who's first, second round draft pick that you're going to be developing. You know, stuff like that, I think you want to do. When you're a team that doesn't have that, you have to decide really how you're going to approach building your roster. And it's very difficult right now, I think, in today's NFL. But I think the first thing that you have to do if you do not have a franchise quarterback is do not buy into a non-franchise quarterback. What I mean by that is if I look at the market and I say that, okay, Mahomes is franchise quarterback, Allen's a franchise quarterback, Watson's a franchise quarterback, Lamar Jackson's a franchise quarterback, Dak Prescott's a franchise quarterback, I'm trying to think of other guys who are probably going to be in that salary range, Aaron Rodgers, franchise quarterback. I'm going to look at those players and they're making 40 to 46, 47 million a year, 50 million a year, I guess, in the case of Rodgers. I cannot look at that at this point and say, okay, I got Ryan Tannehill, I have Kirk Cousins, I have Carson Wentz, I have Baker Mayfield, I have these guys. Well, they want $45 million a year. They're my quarterback. I don't have a choice. You always have a choice. When you don't have a franchise quarterback, what you need to do is constantly keep looking for a franchise quarterback. But for the love of God, do not buy into a non-franchise quarterback at a franchise quarterback price. All you're doing is putting yourself deeply, deeply, deeply at a competitive disadvantage because there's no way to go into free agency to try to build a roster around this substandard quarterback, not substandard, but, you know, average or slightly above average quarterback who's making elite level money. And that's been one of the biggest problems with the NFL was that really post 2013 or so, somewhere in between the Drew Brees getting to 20 million, I think that was 2012, Joe Flacco getting to 20.1, and then Aaron Rodgers quickly deciding he would be at 22 or 23, it created this marketplace where everybody needs to make between 20 and 22. And I think it was 22 million for Rodgers. And it created this system to where every quarterback in the league has to be within a couple million dollars of one another. It creates chaos for all the rest of these teams because you can't compete. If you have Mahomes at 45 and I have Cousins at 45, now Cousins doesn't make 45, but if I have those two players at 45, how are the Vikings going to make up the talent gap that exists between Patrick Mahomes and Kirk Cousins? Okay, they don't play in the same conference. Use Aaron Rodgers as the example. How are you going to make up that difference if those guys make about the same amount of money? You can't. Where you can make up the difference is if you draft a guy and he's only making $6 million a year, $7 million a year, and maybe he happens to only be as good as Kirk Cousins, which is decent. Well, you have a massive payment gap to where you can go out and aggressively pursue players in trades, players in free agency. And I know it's not the best players available in free agency, but you have the ability to sign a bunch of guys and continue to have players in, players out, if you structure your things properly. And you have a benefit, you know, $35 million. $40 million difference between the true elite level quarterbacks and your young player you have. And you can use that to your advantage, because even if the guy is not going to be Patrick Mahomes or Josh Allen or any of those players, he doesn't have to be, because you can surround him with a lot of talent, as long as he's above average, to maybe close that gap enough to where you can knock him off in the playoffs. It only takes one game to knock him off. You know, you can create that team maybe that's good enough as a team to make the playoffs. But you're not going to do it when you double and triple down on these quarterbacks that don't belong there. You know, if you want to tell me that a player, and you know, I probably shouldn't pick on Cousins all the time, because, you know, he's a decent quarterback. And, you know, you want the guys to make money. You know, it's a game you enjoy watching. You know, they should make money. They're the ones out there playing it. But, you know, you're only going to make up that gap if you can get a big difference in salary. You know, if you can get a Cousins type for $20 million, $25 million, everybody else is at 45. Okay, if I have a $20 million gap, you know, with salary cap manipulations and stuff like that, I can probably bring in like two $15 million a year players. And, you know, that's pretty good. You know, that's at least a decent consideration that you can have as to the types of players that you can bring in that maybe the Chiefs would be unable to, or maybe the Bills would be unable to, at least over a long period of time. You know, you can always make things work for a season. But over the long haul, you should be able to do that, whether it's with your cap or your own budget, because you're 20 to 25 million a year less than that. Now, you could also just, you know, bring in one really big name, big money player. If you can go, probably you'd have to trade for someone and find them. But I think that's the way you have to approach it. And that market for the Cousins type of player doesn't exist right now. And it's probably not going to exist for some time. It's going to take a couple of teams that are willing to, you know, hold off on quarterbacks to do it. But the problem is that most teams with the substandard quarterbacks, unless the quarterbacks are absolutely awful, they are not looking for replacements. They're looking to find ways to take an 8-8 team and find a way to get them to 10 wins, or I guess an 8-9 team, you know, and find a way now to get them to 10-7 or 11-6 by making a miracle happen. But the problem is there's no sustainability to it, because you've got a player whose typical season is going to be 500 football. You know, a typical season for the Mahomes types is always going to be 11 or 12 wins. So as long as those guys are healthy, anything that you can add of value is going to just make it easier for them to get to that 11 or 12, or, you know, get to that real level above that that really puts you at a high position. You know, the best you're going to be able to do is probably get to 10, unless there's really a miracle. And again, there's no long-term sustainability, because it all is going to come down to your quarterback, and your quarterback is a 500 quarterback. And you don't have the financial resources to put any kind of long-term competitive team together that can combat the advantage that's gained with those couple of quarterbacks who are really worth the $50 million in salary. So I think you should be seeing all these teams all the time be taking players in the draft, whether it's first round, second round, or third round. Just keep taking shots. Look at the Eagles. The Eagles survived their salary cap mess because they threw a dart and found Jalen Hurts. I don't know if he's going to be good or bad, but it gave them a one-year benefit where they could get out of the Wentz deal and some other, you know, bad contracts they had. And they have a ton of money invested on that team on offense and defense to try to make up whatever gap exists. And in his case, he's making like $1 million a year, $1.5 million. So even if he's giving you, again, the Cousins level of performance, you're paying $30 million less than what those players are earning right now, and probably $45 million less than what some of them are going to be earning in the near future. So, you know, that to me, that should be your example, is look at a team like that. You know, look at what they did when they had a guy under contract that, you know, looked like he was going to be their quarterback for the next 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years. They went out and they proactively said, well, you know, let's take someone. And there's really no harm. You know, because even if that guy just ends up being your backup, I'd rather spend $1 million on Jalen Hurts than $5 million on, I don't know, Josh McCown. Well, he's not playing anymore. But, you know, just whomever. You know, Tyrod Taylor. Taylor's an okay player, but, you know, I'd rather do that. You know, I'd rather have Jalen Hurts than spend $2-3 million on Geno Smith. You know, or Mitchell Trubisky. You know, I'd rather have Jalen Hurts than $8 million on Trubisky. So keep taking your dart throws. You know, don't treat that position until you know you have it. You can't treat that position as if it's done. You know, if you have that mid-grade quarterback, use free agency to do the best you can with that little window, but use your draft to try to find yourself an elite-level quarterback, or at the very least, find yourself a quarterback that can make you more financially competitive, you know, with these other teams. So I think that's the biggest thing. That was a good question, though. I think that's a really good topic. I think that would be something that would be cool to have a couple people talk about. Anyway, that should do it for me. So I'm going to, hopefully I'll get this up tomorrow morning. You know, but might not be out until a bit later. So you might be listening to this on a Tuesday instead of a Monday. But anyway, everybody have a great week, and I will talk to you hopefully, very soon, next weekend, hopefully. All right. Take it easy.